Welcome, very special live edition of the Making Sense podcast, from $5 to financial freedom, how to start investing today. Now look, the share market is an incredibly powerful tool for your money. You guys know that I am such a fan of it. It can help you earn so that you don't have to go to work every day until you die. It also doesn't have to be that complicated. There are powerful ways to invest that are also really simple ways to invest. So today, we're going to be laying out how it works, also some key strategies for making your money work harder for you. And if you like this webinar, then you are going to love the brand new newsletter that I am launching. It's called The Market Memo, and it's more of this, really. It's tidbits in your inbox each week to help you understand the share market and start investing with confidence. Now look, you'll get an email after this that tells you all about it. For those who are listening back on the podcast, I'll also link it in the description so you can get more info about that newsletter after the webinar. Really exciting. But for now, let's not waste time. Let's get into things. Don't forget, of course, we've already made a little bit of you saying hi to each other in the chat section, and you can drop your questions in. That is why we are live. That is why we love to do this live, so that your burning questions can be answered. Sound off in the comments. Let's talk about it. Now, look, we're about to get into it properly, but we do have to do a quick little disclaimer. I know it's the boring bit, but it's important. This is not and cannot be individual financial advice. Everything we talk about here, it's going to be general information. From there, you need to adapt it to your own individual financial situation. You know your life better than we ever can. And of course, all of us are different. So if you would like someone to give you individual financial advice, financial advisor, always the best bet. Right. After that, though, time to introduce our wonderful panel. And I am really excited about the people that we've got here for you today, because it is stellar lineup, if I do say so myself. Look, we've got Ruth Henderson first up. Now, excuse me, I am both producer and host, but here's Ruth. And she is the host of the Happy Saver podcast and the blog site as well. Talks all about financial freedom, shares her own money journey, as well as the journeys of other people who are either on their way to financial freedom or have achieved it. Pioneer in this space. So welcome, Ruth. Really pleased to have you here. We've also got Paul Macbeth, a fellow financial journalist, who is also the founder of thebottomline.co.nz, gives you great market insights and news. Last but never least, we have Dean Anderson from Kernel. Now, if you're interested in the share market, you have probably come across his company already, but it is a digital platform, gives you access to investment funds, KiwiSaver options, has his finger on the pulse of what's happening in the market right now. So welcome to all of you. Thank you so much for coming on. Look, we're going to start with, I think there can be some myths and sometimes confusion around shares. So Ruth, I'll start with you. What do you think is a misconception about the share market, or a myth that you would like to bust?
I'm going to try and keep this brief for you, Francis, and everybody. It's probably the more you meddle, the better the results. I think that's a complete myth. Investing the way we do, the less we do, the wealthier we become. So we are not Warren Buffett. He is definitely a one-off. And I think it's you find one big thing to buy, invest frequently, and just let it ride.
100%. It is that thing, isn't it, where we're so conditioned to, if you put in more effort, you get more back. Not always the case. Paul, what do you think? Myth you'd like to bust?
Oh, it's always that it's just for rich people. But things have changed so much. And even, I mean, it's never been just for rich people, but it's just a great way to diversify things and to think about things differently. Banks and houses aren't the only way to make money, basically.
100%. All right. This gets thrown around a lot, but it's because it's true. The democratization of the share market, it is easier than ever to get into it. And it's such an exciting time, I think, to be someone who's interested in investing. Dean, what about you? Myth you'd like to bust?
Yeah, I think you raised a good point, though, just that access and being cheaper has not made better outcomes, right? So just because it's easier to now trade a share and faster than ever, that doesn't mean it's necessarily the best approach to building wealth, which is what Bruce sort of was touching on as well. But I think one of the misconceptions that maybe people have is that when you buy a share, you're not actually giving money to the company. You are literally buying something off somebody else and exchanging that share with somebody else. So again, coming back to that sort of stock picking mentality, somebody on the other side has made a decision that they want to sell when you've made a decision that you want to buy. So remember that there's always different views as to what may be happening in the world. But yeah, I think people often think that when they're maybe buying shares, that that is to the company and you're buying shares off the company, when actually we're just trading existing shares between ourselves.
Yes, I've heard it described as, and I love this analogy, that you think of the vast majority of shares trading a bit like eBay or Trade Me, where a lot of us are actually saying, okay, I want to sell, I'll put it on the market, someone else wants to buy, then it can get bid up. It's a easier way to think about it, I think. Whereas when you're actually buying off a company, that's quite a rare situation. That's an IPO, but we'll get into that more later. I mean, we'll go around again in terms of, I'd like to hear everyone's thoughts on this. And this time I'll start with you, Dean. If someone is interested in shares, but they don't know where to start, do you think there's a good first step?
Well, often this is framed as a good place to start, but in reality, it's actually the best place for everybody. And that is what we've talked about, is diversification is key here, right? Like, picking one individual stock is a real challenge. The odds are that that won't outperform the market and you carry a lot of risk. But you can buy from as little as a dollar now, really low cost diversified funds. So in one go, you're now diversified across hundreds or thousands of companies, countries, all in one purchase. And really what you're then doing is, I'm just taking a share in the long-term economic growth of our societies, of our businesses as a whole, and as our economy. So that's really easy to do. You can buy an ETF or an index fund. It's often framed as that's a great place to start, but actually, it's the logical approach for even the most successful and largest investors. And Warren Buffett is actually a very big proponent of actually every investor using index funds as part of their portfolio, and has that set down for some of his wealth when he passes.
Yeah, I love Warren Buffett, and he has got some very quotable quotes on how to invest. He's a great one. Paul, what about you? Do you think there's a good place to start when you're first looking at it?
Oh, and when you're first looking, you just go to those places where you're trying to find out what it is, right? So you read the business pages and actually read them. You look at your KiwiSaver monthly updates and actually read it. You look at sorted.org.nz, which gives you all of those sorts of the information. You go to places like personal finance, blogs, columns. You watch the podcasts, because it's one of those things that builds and builds and builds and builds. There's always new jargon coming out every year. And you learn these concepts and what you should be looking for and why you should be looking for it and what you want to achieve out of it from just being on top of these things and talking to other people. So it's like, financial advisors sort of are there in the step, but it's a gradual thing. Like, you just start small and then just build your way up. If I sort of think about, 2008 when I first started, having to look at this sort of stuff, 28-year-old me would have no idea what 45-year-old me knows.
I know. It's crazy, isn't it? It's one of those things where I think there's a real balance between, you don't have to know everything all at once. You can also keep learning as you go and keep refining. There's this real pressure, I think, sometimes where we think with our money, we should know everything before we can ever move. Whereas you can start and keep building that knowledge as you go. I still like to, very busy life these days, but I dip in and out of the financial pages, keeping an eye on what's going on. Reading a fascinating article just this morning about the stellar run that gold has been having. I don't even invest in gold, but I just find it interesting. And I think it's good to just keep an eye on things. Of course, the trick is making sure that you don't keep too close of an eye and freak yourself out sometimes. But we'll come to that later in the conversation. What about you, Ruth? If someone's getting started, what do you think is a good place to start?
I talk to so many people who are just getting started. So I think the best resource, hands down, is J.L. Collins, who wrote The Simple Path to Wealth back in 2016, something like that. And I just say to people, in your podcast app, just search J.L. Collins, The Simple Path to Wealth. He's re-released his original book this year. So he's been interviewed 20 different times. Listen to half a dozen of the interviews. Read his book. I have it. I post his book all over the country all the time. And also he did a Google talk back in, I think it was about 2018, literally at Google, which is on YouTube, where he talked about The Simple Path to Wealth. And it just gives a crash course in investing and will steer a lot of people off stock picking from the very beginning, so we don't all have to make the mistake of trying to pick stocks before course correcting to just doing what Dean's on about and just buy all the stocks, basically. So that's like my go-to resource to start, J.L. Collins, A Simple Path to Wealth.
Do you know what's funny is you saying about, you know, he was on all these podcasts through this year. And yeah, he just popped up. Mm. I'd somehow missed that he was re-releasing his book. And so that's very exciting. He popped up on one of my favorite podcasts as a guest. And I got a little bit starstruck.
Yeah.
And I really don't get starstruck very often. I really pride myself on just everyone's a person. But he popped up unexpectedly on one of my podcasts. And I was just like, oh, J.L. Collins, he's so great. So he really is. He The Simple Path to Wealth could not have a better name because he really breaks it down simply. So I think that's a great recommendation there. I mean, Ruth, you have talked a lot about your own journey as well as other people's journeys to financial freedom, and you have really used shares to propel your own financial freedom journey. So tell me a little bit about how you use them for your own personal strategy.
So we learned the hard way and now refined it down. And I was very fortunate enough to meet Dean, actually, many, many, many years ago when I was doing the research and looking for the information like we were just talking about. And that, and like he sort of backed up what J.L. Collins had been talking about. So that sent me well and truly down the kind of ETF path. So Johnny and I, our strategy is basically create a big gap between what we earn, what we spend, and we invest that difference. And so every month we aim to invest about 30% of our take-home pay into just one huge global total world fund. That end, basically. We invest every single month without fail. We have not missed a month for the last coming up to a decade now. And so slow and steady wins the race, dollar cost averaging, because that's what most people, that's all that most people can do. Most people don't come into $1 million once a year or whenever to invest. So we've just dollar cost averaged in for all these years into one fund. And now we're just waiting for it to build. And I'm all about simple math, Francis. So I just basically think for every $100,000 we have invested, $4,000 to $5,000 of that, 4% to 5% of that amount technically could be sold as income each year. So we are trying to get as many multiples of $100,000 invested as we can. And it's just slow and steady wins the race. But I think I saw you on Instagram the other day, you did something about, you know, compounding, how it kind of starts to blow your mind after a while. And we're reaching that phase now that, you know, the month-on-month, year-on-year growth shows us that this just a simple path to wealth, it legitimately works. So yeah, nice and simple.
Yeah, 100%. And I've dropped into the chat for anyone who's following this live, I've dropped the link to the J.L. Collins book because I think it is a brilliant resource there. And yeah, as you say, I mean, the compounding impact of as your money goes into the share market, it earns a bit, that profit then can go on, earn profits. Our brains are not set up to figure out just how powerful that is. But 5 years, 10 years, it's going to pass anyway. And what you can achieve by just sticking some money aside and ignoring it and letting it do its thing is actually mind-blowing. I am not someone who's a maths whiz. My poor maths teacher mother, I'm a horrendous disappointment. I shouldn't say that. She's so lovely. But I am a disappointment on the maths front. She tried to tutor me through high school. Don't recommend that for good family relations. But just Google compound interest calculator and how much you can put in each week. And then the share market, depending on what measure you use, is between 7% and 10% per year. you put that in, and you will be amazed how that line just hockey sticks up. It is really crazy. Dean, you know, we've given a little shout out already to index funds. When you started Kernel, you had a very strong focus on index funds. I mean, not to put words in your mouth about your own business, but I would say they're very much the core of your company. I mean, why did you focus on those index funds? What do you think are their strengths for share market investing?
Yeah, look, so I guess we frame ourselves, and there's a lot of debate, and you'll see a lot of research around active versus passive investing and how hard it is to stock pick. And that evidence is pretty irrefutable. There's a great source called SPIVA, S&P Indices versus Active. We can share a link to it. And they have effectively for 30 odd years now measured the performance of active funds against an index, which most markets over the long term shows 9, 9.5 out of 10 will underperform the index. So your best is simply maybe own an index, at least for the core part of your portfolio. And so that's what we believe in. We're effectively a data company, you know, where the facts tell us an outcome. That's what we'll deliver for our customers. And so we were trying to build up a broad range of index funds. We wanted to be more tax efficient, more fee efficient, all the things that we can control that we know set up for a good financial future. And so that's kind of what we've done. And then we've continued to expand on that to give people the choice and flexibility that they need for all stages of their life and also help with their own engagement and personal interest. And so, you know, the super tax geeks out there who may want to optimize their tax by buying $49,000 of offshore ETFs before they use a New Zealand fund. And there's those that want to core satellite with a range of index funds and then have one or two stocks alongside. And so really we're looking at the data and the facts and trying to build a platform. And I guess what does our mission, the thing I think the hardest problem we're trying to solve, technology has meant that, you know, access and speed and fees, none of those are a problem anymore. You know, you can start investing with a dollar into a low-cost index fund with very limited fees. What we haven't been good at anywhere in the world yet solving is financial outcomes. That's the complicated problem we're trying to work on, is how do you make the technology experience that keeps people engaged and create the right habits and behavior that will give better outcomes? Because what we've seen is, in many markets, speed and access has been enabled, but a lot of investors have not necessarily resulted in better outcomes. Either they don't stick with it, or they start, you know, they give up, or they go down the wrong course, et cetera. So that's a really hard problem that nobody's really solved yet that we'll keep working on. We've got the building blocks of the investment options, but how do you make people better informed at a platform level?
Yeah, that is a really tricky thing, isn't it? Because we have seen even, you know, from the Financial Markets Authority here in New Zealand, that they have started making noises about there needing to be more from the investing platforms about helping their customers make good choices. Because we used to have the brokers, and okay, that was really tough in terms of, I have talked to people who got laughed out of offices not that long ago for having $10,000 to invest. It blows my mind. Like, that is a totally different world from the one we were in, the one we're in now. But that wasn't that long ago. I think when I talked to that person, it happened about 10 years ago, which is crazy. But of course, as you say, with that greater access and now being able to do a dollar a time, then we have a different switch in terms of, okay, if everyone can do this, how do we make sure that we're doing it well? I mean, Paul, if we look at things like funds, we've given a big shout out to index funds. If we're looking at these funds where you have lots of different companies in them, there are so many different options even amongst funds as an investing option. How safe are they? And how do you research your best option?
That's how long is a piece of string, right? Like funds aren't all equal. And even the idea of index funds being stretched across all of these sorts of different companies, well, the weightings, you know, you just take a look at the S&P 500, right? So really, outside of the Magnificent Seven, nothing else matters. They are so dominant within that, that it drives everything up and down at the moment. And you see that across, you know, most indices. In New Zealand, Fisher & Paykel Healthcare, Infratil, those two are the big things that push around the 50. How risky they are is down to your underlying, what the underlying assets are within it. Like, so you, without getting too far into it, you at least want to have an idea of what you're investing in. And this is part and parcel of the, you know, fobbing off your sort of decision-making is, well, where do you get to the point where you've got no idea what's actually underneath it? Like, are you chucking something into a highly leveraged, like, you know, people are borrowing money to invest in things based on digital assets, which these options are available to you. You can't go in with blind eyes. You do need, even though there are a lot of strategies out there to try and make things simple over the long term, you still need to have an idea of what you're doing. Like, and you can't sort of give up your own responsibility for that. Like, you know, we're basically grown-ups if we're going to be putting aside a bit of money for various things. And you know, it's in your own interest to actually understand what you're doing and why.
Yeah. Yeah. I know it's tricky, isn't it? Because funds are sort of the easier way to get started. We always talk about that you can be getting into several hundred companies at once. That is, of course, the holy grail. We talk about diversification. You don't want to be invested in just one company, even just one industry. A fund can really spread you around. And yet, there are still so many ways to do it. There are global funds. There are country by country funds. There are even industry specific funds. Now, this is wonderful. It gives you so many options, but I think it can get a little bit overwhelming. Ruth, you talk to people a lot who are at this beginning stage of their journey. Is there, I mean, you know, you mentioned before the J.L. Collins simple path to wealth sort of strategy. Is there something within that that you think works for a lot of people, even if we acknowledge that nothing will work for everyone? Is there something that works for a lot of people when they're getting started?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what Paul's saying there is, like, I don't go to the supermarket for my nutritional education. I go there for my groceries, and I kind of feel the same way about investment companies, a lot of investment companies. I don't want their financial advice. I just want the product that they're selling that is appropriate for what I'm doing. It's the same with investment providers, that they, in their heart, believe that one fund is right for all, but they've got such a massive range of customers who are asking for different things. But for me, thinking back to that Spiva index, Dean, it's like, when I know that if you just buy the average and it outperforms everything else, why would I even look at anything else? And so when I'm talking to people, I'm just like, read J.L. Collins, keep it simple and buy the whole world, and, you know, or the US 500 or big company, because it's just, people need to manage their own money and they're perfectly capable of managing their own money. But the investment industry, because it's just this massive industry, has made it unnecessarily complicated for the end user, because it's in the interest of the company, because they're a company, they're trying to make money. And so the best thing they can do is offer various products to as wide an audience as they can. That's how they make money, sort of thing. So manage your own money. And I'm always saying to people, you're perfectly capable of doing it. Just find some key resources and always be looking into what is in it for them. You know, particularly the ones that advertise the most boldly, what is in it for them, et cetera. So does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, no, I think it really does, Ruth, and some great points there. I mean, I think the other thing as well, and sticking with you for a second, Ruth, you know, when people are starting, they often start small. Is there an amount that you think is sort of quote unquote worth it in order to invest? Are there pros and cons to the amount that you would choose?
So we've all got to start somewhere. So $1, $5, $10, whatever you got, start somewhere. And I always use my daughter as she's been my test case, not interested in money, which has been the best thing ever for me. And so from the get-go, when she made a dollar, I made her invest half of that dollar. And so, you know, 50% investment. And then as her income has grown, she still must invest half of that. And so, and what that's done is, initially she hated me for it, but then she got the hang of it. And now she sees those investment returns. So she can see, I've put X amount in, and now my growth is such and such, and now my total amount is this. And so for people who are just starting out, I just always encourage people to start small, $10, $50, whatever it might be. Learn the process, the provider that you're choosing to use. Learn their systems. I always sort of say, buy, hold it for a minute, sell it, complete the loop, understand it. But don't fool yourself that investing as little as $5 grows up goes into a big, huge investment. It's not going to. The more you invest, the wealthier you're going to be. And so looking at the income you make and working out a percentage of that that you can invest and make it meaningful. Like if you earn $100,000 a year and only invest 1%, well, you are going to be working till the age of 65. You know, the more you can invest, 20, 30, 40%, the higher your growth is going to be over time. So invest what you've got today, but track, monitor, and get it as high as you possibly can.
I so agree with that. I mean, I've talked about this so much. So people who are regular listeners of the podcast might get really annoyed now that I'm about to repeat myself, but it's still true. So I'm going to do it. Where I don't think I would have ever started if I hadn't let myself start with $5 a week. I don't think I would have ever started because it was scary. And because I actually didn't have much money at the time, starting with that $5 a week, I got to learn a little bit by doing. I'd already done some learning, but sometimes you also have to put yourself through it. You know, you don't get stronger by reading about lifting weights. You've got to do it sometimes. And then as I've earned more, as I got more comfortable with it, I increased that amount. But I don't think I would have ever gone from zero to $100 a week. You know, I just had to start somewhere. I mean, Dean, we were talking earlier about the fact that companies like yours have really opened it up to make it easier for the everyday person to have invest. You know, we've gone from those $10,000 minimums to the $1 minimum, which is so exciting. But as you've already said, does change things, right? What do you think has changed for the strategy for the average person?
Look, I think what's been really heartening, and I don't know whether it's to do with the brand or the content or sort of the messaging we have, we've not really seen a change in behaviors. And the things that we look at as sort of those metrics that are probably really important to us are things like what percentage of our customers have an auto invest, you know, and I think we've probably got the market leading rate for that. You know, we're talking a very high percent of our customers are regularly investing, building their wealth. And so there are those behavioral metrics that we look at that go actually, the things that we're doing are creating the right outcomes. Most people, while you can self-select your key, we say with the kernel, vast majority are going, I just want the high growth fund or I want the balance fund. Some may put a little bit of something on the side, and that's good if that, you know, you may have other assets or you know, just want that to be engaged. That's your choice. But most people are actually sticking to the course and doing sort of the good basics that we all talk about on here. But can I do a little political plug almost here right now? The thing that I would love to see next year, and I think really important for listeners is to have this engagement around KiwiSaver, because we have an election next year. And the minister recently highlighted at an industry event that you expect to see superannuation and KiwiSaver as a leading policy discussion for next year's election. Change is coming. And so the things that I think need to be seen here is from a superannuation point of view, we know that probably over time with the demographic changes and an aging population, NZ Super will need to go up. I don't see it disappearing, but the age of access needs to go up. And hey, let's be real, we're also fit and healthy. And most people at 65 want to still have some form of work and are active in their lives, right? One of the big changes that occurred this year was the government cut in half the contribution, the, you know, the annual tax credit you got. So if you put in $1,000, you get $500 from the government, right? We're spending about $1 billion a year on that. So that's quite a lot of money that we as taxpayers effectively spending. And most of that just ended up as a middle-class kind of tax credit. It didn't actually change any behaviors. So that's now been cut in half. The thing I would love to see is rethink, how do we create over the long term a better financially empowered Kiwi community? And I think that government contribution should move from being a tax credit for the middle class to they should be giving it to everybody aged 0 to 16 or 18. If you as a parent match it. And if anybody's on a social network support, give it to them for free without it. It is half the cost. So it doesn't cost us any more as a country. But what that does is gives us a whole generation of people coming through the system who actually have tangible dollars, their own dollars, when they get to 16 or 18 that they can see has been growing. It's theirs. They understand it. They can feel empowered. Because as Ruth's highlighted, right, it's very hard to sit down with an 18-year-old and try and teach them financial literacy with theory and say, oh, over time, this will compound. Just trust me, in 20 years, you'll understand. If we actually get people involved from day dot and start to get them the system, and you couple that with financial literacy in schools, we're going to very quickly turn around our country and having a whole bunch of people out there who feel financially secure, are competent about their savings and investing and money. And The beauty is it costs us nothing more as a country. It's just a reallocation to something that has much more impact. And so think about this. The KiwiSaver and superannuation is probably going to be a big discussion point next year. I've been talking a lot about it, about actually let's be bold and make some structural tweaks that actually will set us on a much more powerful path going forward.
I'm already prepared for my blood to get a little bit heated as we talk KiwiSaver and politics next year. It's one of my favourite passion topics to get absolutely wound up about. Paul, we've talked quite a lot about investing sort of more broadly. What about the share market itself? What's going on with it at the moment? Because it's kind of been all over the place. The world's been a bit funky. We've talked about that in previous lives. New Zealand at the moment hasn't been looking great the last time I checked. The US has been looking a bit better, but it's up and down every day. I'll admit I didn't check this morning, so I might already be out of touch because it's changing so fast sometimes. Do you have a bit of a snapshot on what's happening at the moment? And is now a good time even to be investing?
Oh, it's always a good time to be an investor. As we had earlier said, there's two sides to every coin. There's a buyer and a seller on every transaction. Your real issue is when there's none of one. But the stock market. So if you're looking at stock markets, and New Zealand's not actually doing that bad. We're positive for the year, still above 13,000, which that's a very high benchmark. I remember scratching my head about it when I was yakking about it with a broker a few years ago. We were just thinking 13,000, this is ludicrous territory. Liberation Day, when Trump 2.0 decided that let's reorder trade and set the markets into a tailspin, that's all come back. This is the volatility. And this is the thing that when you spend a bit too much time looking at stock markets in particular, don't even get me started on currencies, because that's where I started. But those things whip all over the place. You do need to expect the highs and the lows. And we're still seeing interest rates are coming back down. So as interest rates go down, companies get easier to borrow money. They want to spend more, invest more back in their business. What you get out of your term deposit doesn't look as attractive. So maybe that dividend that Spark's paying looks a little tastier. Like, relativities are how all of these things sort of meld into one. So getting back to your, what's it looking like? It's looking all right. We've gone past it. But even if you think about the headlines last week about the economy being in an absolute funk, which we know it is and has been, but that's 3 months ago now almost. That's June, when we were really down in the dumps and we didn't know what was going on in the world. We knew that the new administration at the White House was going to do stuff. I don't think anyone quite thought it was going to end up like that. But things are looking a bit better now. Like, when you're looking at some of those forward-looking indicators, the pieces of data, people spending money, this, that, and the next thing, people are looking at feeling a bit more confident. So even when you're talking to the fund managers out there, the brokers, the investment managers, they're saying, and they always say this because they have to be optimistic, right? You're not investing if you don't have a certain amount of optimism that things will go up. But they do say that it feels like they're past the trough. So is it a good time to invest? It always is, as long as, if you're dollar cost averaging over time, in the long run should work for you. If you're short-term speculating, that can go either way, depending on what you're short-term speculating on, as long as you know exactly what you're doing and why. The typical journalist's answer, kind of.
I love that. We're getting some great questions through in the chat, so I'm going to whip through a few of those. I mean, one that we can probably address quite quickly says, would you recommend if I want to invest for 6 months/short term? I mean, look, the general info on that is that the share market is for money that you don't want to touch for sort of 5 to 10 years. Or, if you're really dead set that you want to do it for 6 months or so, then you shouldn't be relying on that money at all. It is much riskier in the short term. Usually the 6 months time frame is more like a savings account or a term deposit. Much riskier in that short term, much more those sort of standard 7 to 10% returns that I was talking about earlier. that usually comes through when you're talking in the 5 to 10 year period. So that's the general line on that. Dean, I'm going to send this other one your way from Hannah. This is a brilliant question. And I think what's good here is just to say, Dean's company obviously has both KiwiSaver options and other investment fund options. So he can give you the industry perspective here without you needing to worry that he's pushing you towards one or the other, because he doesn't mind as long as you're investing. So here from Hannah, if your intention is to save for retirement, are there benefits or pitfalls to investing more in KiwiSaver versus another portfolio sort of investment option outside of alongside KiwiSaver? Dean, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I'll give Colonel as an example, because actually it's a pretty common thing these days, is that we've got the same funds and the same fees in and out of KiwiSaver. So there's no fee difference, there's no selection difference. You can do the same in either. Obviously, the benefit with your KiwiSaver is you're going to have an employer matching. So at the very least, I think that you want to be having that conversation, go, okay, if my employer is matching, not as part of a total remuneration, but giving 3% to match my 3%, and that's obviously going to go up next year, make the most of that. The reason, there's no other than that $250 a year government contribution now, there aren't that many additional structural benefits to KiwiSaver in terms of there's no tax benefits or other, you know, easy wins. What KiwiSaver can be really good for, though, is discipline. So if you are not a good automatic saver, if you're not habitual and going, okay, outside of KiwiSaver, we are going to save the $5, $10, $100 a month, a week, whatever it may be, as sort of Ruth highlights as the power, KiwiSaver is good because it is that discipline. So you could increase your own contributions into KiwiSaver from 3 to 4 to 6 to 8. If you are investing for retirement and you just want that good habit, so i.e. it's going out and it's being invested before I see it in my bank account, that is actually quite good for a lot of people who just are much better to budget on what's left over rather than trying to budget to invest after it's received in their bank account.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really strong points there. And there was another question in the chat as well that was saying, let me pull it up. Sorry, it was about ethical investing. Basically saying, are there any index funds that have had consistent returns over the last 15 years or so that don't test on animals? I've struggled to find any. Now, look, the strong recommendation from me is head to the Mindful Money website. That's mindfulmoney.nz. I will drop that into the chat for you. They do a really good job of, you can not only say I'm interested in ethical investing, but if something like the testing on animals is really important to you, you can actually filter the ethical investing that you are most bothered by, like animal testing. So I think that's a good resource to start with.
I was going to jump in on that one. That is an interesting. So we have like a world index, and there's lots of options outside. Like if you want a foreign ETF, I'm sure you'll be able to find those. Mindful Money covers New Zealand funds, so you can obviously access offshore ETFs if there is a quite more particular, you know, values alignment that you're looking for. So you'll have to do a bit more of a global search. One thing to be conscious of, we developed a world index fund, and it has some ESG screens, and we excluded non-pharma animal testing. And this was a real interesting challenge when it comes to animal testing. And again, this all depends on the reality. You know, everyone's got different values. And so you'll have to find and understand the details of each investment to make sure it's aligned up to what you're after. You know, we can't build bespoke for everybody. So that's on you to go and do that research. But the animal testing was interesting, that if you just included a blanket animal testing, pure, is there any or not? The problem was you ended up excluding the entire healthcare system. And the reality is that most things are regulated to have to go through that process. So not necessarily a company, they just have to be able to go through a testing regime that is regulated, that they're required to do that. And so the problem then is you end up quite distorting the investment universe because of that. And so I think what most people are quite initially conscious of is that sort of voluntary testing, you know, the cosmetics type stuff that really doesn't, like that unnecessary kind of, you know, that's what most people are very concerned about. So do think about it. But yeah, Mindful Money is good for New Zealand. But if you want other options, you'll have to dive deeper into overseas.
Yeah. Do you know what? We should do an ethical investing deep dive at some point, because those sorts of issues are fascinating to me. There are so many great funds that do a really, really good job. As you say, when you get into the nitty gritty, it's quite tricky to make sure it always lines up with your own personal views. There's often some sort of compromise in there. So we should do that at some point. Team listening, let me know in the chat if you're interested in that. No problem if you're not, but if you are interested in it, maybe we can do that in the future. Ruth, you know, I hinted at this earlier. I mean, I always have to do a bit of quick research before I talk about the share market, because my own personal investing strategy is, and this, again, is not going to be news to anyone who's read my books, listened to the podcast for a while. I love a good broad index fund. I just chuck my money in there. I don't really think about it much from there. I automate it. I just go for it. My personal strategy does not really require me to do much paying attention to the share market on a weekly, daily basis, whatever. It's for work that I will keep an eye on things. So before I have a chat like this, I will, you know, quickly scoot over, like, what's been happening in the headlines? What's going on? And what about yourself? Do you look at market ups and downs? Do they ever bother you at all?
No. No and no, yeah. So no, I got better things to do with my life than watch what the share market's doing. And pretty much if I hear it on the news, I know it's down, because that's all they talk about is when it goes down. And I did more recently put an app on my phone where I track some big funds. And we just reached an all-time high a couple of days ago. So no, I do not track it daily. If it plunges, I don't. On it, I think in the early days, my heart rate maybe used to change. Nothing these days. So I'm like you, I just invest month in, month out. I probably check it more than others because I do get lots of questions and I always share what I'm up to. So I can share, like, I did look for you this morning, Francis, and things are going great. So month on, 22 days into the month, things are booming. When I compare back to last year, things are going very nicely, but I do not pay attention day to day at all. There's no need to. We're doing this for 20, 30, 40 years. There is no need to check it on the daily.
Exactly. I do feel like as long as you are doing a bit of research at the beginning and you sort of understand the share market itself and you understand what you are trying to get out of it, you can very often then set up from there. Automation is your best friend. I just did a post about that. Automation is wonderful. Just chuck it in, continue. If things really, truly change over the course of, you think this is going to change things for decades to come, sure, you can have a little tweak from there. But I think for the most part, you really probably don't need to. This is a great question in the chat, and I'm going to quickly whip around everyone for this. What is the best piece of investing advice you've received that you think more investors should hear? And what is the worst investing advice that you often see beginners fall for? So best and worst investment advice. Paul, let's start with you.
Well, best would be if it seems too good to be true, it is. Because, I mean, yeah, if someone's selling you snake oil, it's not going to make any money. The worst, I find that a bit trickier because, it goes back to that whole thing of, you know, what are you actually trying to do to achieve out of this? And I think the worst would probably be that there's a one size fits all. But, you know, people have different intentions on whatever they're trying to achieve out of their short term, medium term, long term investment goals. And you got different mechanisms to get there. Like, we're not all carbon copies in similar situations.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's very true. There is a lot of, you know, as we've said the whole way through this, a lot of good general info that can work for a lot of people. And after that, then you've still got to think about what are my goals? What are the things I'm wanting to achieve? And that's always going to guide what you're doing with that information, you know. Ruth, what about you? Best and worst investing advice?
Don't take financial advice off people who have no money. There's so many people with an opinion and I'm pretty chatty. And when somebody will say something to me like, this is a foregone conclusion, I'll ask a lot of questions only to realize that they're full of complete bollocks. So don't take financial advice of people who've got no money. Worst financial advice, best financial advice. Just live on less than you make and invest the difference. Always be investing something from every single paycheck because invested money grows and makes money. And so that's money that you can then use in your life, whether it be to, you know, pay for things that are a bit more expensive at the moment or to retire early like we're planning to do or to use in your retirement at the age of 65.
Yeah. Love it. Love it. All right, Dean, your turn. Best and worst investing advice.
And I had it right there on my brain and now it's gone completely blank.
More coffee needed.
I do. I will do the worst though, and maybe the best will come back to me because it was great advice. I'm sure it was. The worst one that I think that we've seen, particularly recently with social media, is this idea of buy the brands you know, invest in the brands you know. That's a really commonly thrown out way of, hey, just start by buying the brands you know. And people went and buy Air New Zealand or they buy Nike. Just because you know the brand does not make it a good investment. And I think it was used as quite an easy way to get people engaged to try and just start. But yeah, that really doesn't result in a good investment. Come back to being diversified and, you know, how many of us would have actually known about NVIDIA 10 years ago, right? That is not a brand that I'm sure 99% of Kiwis had ever heard of or were familiar with, right? And so think about that. And I think we've covered off like most of the good advice here, right? You know, this idea of diversification, regular contributions, and going on that journey.
Yeah, I agree. I did hear a lot, especially maybe 3 or 4 years ago. I think I heard that really all the time, you know, buy the things that you know. And it's one of those pieces of advice that I think got so simplified as to be useless and also got sort of repurposed in a way that was, yeah, just not quite the original intention. Just because you see Nike everywhere doesn't mean you actually understand what the company is doing. And it just, yeah, it. I agree. That one got under my skin a wee bit. Look, we're almost running out of time. Ruth, I want to hit something with you because I think this picks up on something that's coming through a lot in the questions. It's not a specific question, but there's an undertone of this in a lot of the questions because the emotional side of investing can really matter. How do you think someone stops themselves getting either too excited and being pushed by FOMO with their money or panicking, selling if they hit a rough patch? Emotions and money really shouldn't mix, should they?
No, it's keep your emotions out of it. Like, go and have an emotional time somewhere else. This is business. This is investing. It's like, and like when people, you know, if I'm sitting with somebody at a picnic or something and they flick through on their investing app all the millions of things they were investing in and the likes of that, and I'm like, well, why did you buy that? Oh, for a bit of fun. And it's like, go for a run. Go and have your fun elsewhere. Get emotional elsewhere. It's like investing done well is so simple, just simple. Find a fund, invest in it often. It's habits, it's routine, it's setting aside money to invest regularly. And then it's also tracking it. Like, so every single month, first of every month, I look at our investments and I tote down the value of each of them and then I add it up. And then what do I want to see it getting more and more and more over time? And as that starts to build, you back off. Anything new is fun and interesting. You want to dabble with it. But over time, this should be the most boring thing you do. And so you're not getting emotional about it. It's not exciting. Investing to me is not exciting. It's just something that I need to do. And then I think it's understanding why you are doing this, because a lot of people don't think about why am I putting this money aside. We talk less about what you will do with it. And so that's why I'm sort of always writing about and talking about, you know, applying the 4 or 5% rule, because one day when I need this money, I will be selling off small amounts at a time to replace the income from the job that I no longer want to do. And so if people are heading for traditional retirement and they're building up their KiwiSaver or another investment, why are you doing it? Because you're going to have a gap in between the superannuation and what you actually spend. And that invested money, that is that gap. And you start to run basic math. You and I are the same on the math front there, Francis. And so start playing out, why am I doing this? How is this going to work? And I think then the emotional side of investing, you just back off. Go and be emotional elsewhere. This is just business. And you can keep it very straightforward.
So agree with you. I'm going to agree you to death on this, Ruth. I always do.
And also, and two last things on that. Like, if you're tempted, burn your logins and also talk to somebody about it. So like if you've got a partner, talk to them about investing. And like the thing I've managed to do with my the Happy Saver community is there's so many people talking either to me or that I've connected with each other that they just run ideas past and they can just, I don't understand this, I'm worried about this, I'm thinking about this, what do you think? And just somebody who has the knowledge, you know, and just basic knowledge and are doing these things, investing this way, they've got the right behaviours. Talk to those sorts of people and then you'll just chill the heck out.
Yeah, love it. Dean, you've always got the good Warren Buffett quotes. Was it Warren that said something? Warren, we're on first name terms. But was it him that said that good investing should be like watching paint dry? Was that a Warren Buffett?
Yeah, and yeah, he's had many quotes about the long-term index investing approach and yeah, removing the emotions, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a classic one. All right, well, we're right up on it. So I'm going to whip around all of you. If you had $5 to invest today, where would you personally invest it, bearing in mind that you might have different goals from the rest of our audience? This is a personal chat. Starting with you, Paul.
Oh, pour it obviously into Curious Media and The Bottom Line, an exciting media startup.
TheBottomLine.co.nz, people. It's where you get all of your fabulous market news and analysis from. Paul churning out great stuff for us there. Dean, what about you? If you had $5 to invest, where would you be putting it?
Yeah, not unlike Paul. In the sense that, you know, and this is maybe another interesting topic. New Zealand is full of self-starters, people who build businesses from the small to the large. We're building rockets into, you know, space now, right? And so there is this natural desire to be entrepreneurial and start your own business and have control over your destiny. And for some people, they may do that through investing. Others may start a business. And, you know, we started Kernel 6 years ago. And I had investment properties, been there, so glad not to be involved in investment property anymore, but put every dollar into getting Kernel off the ground and hopefully more Kiwis invest. And so that is literally where my money goes, either into the business or in funds via the business. And so that's living and breathing, index investing, end to end.
Love it. All right, Ruth, we'll finish with you.
Smart, Total World Fund, unhedged all the way. And if either of these guys' two companies are any good, they might turn up in my fund one day.
Yeah. Love it. Love it. I'm very similar to you, Ruth, in that I just cannot go past a good global index fund. That is still very much the core of my investing strategy today. Thank you all so much for coming on and sharing your knowledge, whipping through some of that with us. And thank you for listening, joining, giving us your great questions. Of course, we had Ruth Henderson from The Happy Saver, Paul Macbeth from TheBottomLine.co.nz, and Dean Anderson from Kernel. Now, if you want more like this, there is, of course, only so much we can do in one webinar. So join us at the Market Memo newsletter, where you're going to get all of these good tips and tricks. We're going to be breaking down the share market each week. And that is going to be in the description of this podcast. You'll also get an email if you signed up for this webinar. So make sure you hit subscribe there. And of course, hit subscribe to the Making Sense podcast while you're at it. And between the two, you will never miss a trick with your money. Until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.